You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Bart Elmore, Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University, author of Seed Money, Monsanto's Past, and Our Food Future. Also on the program today, a federal judge says Trump's records can be released to the January 6th commission. That's not good. Appeal. Meanwhile, Trump and Republican voters assault the Republicans' House members who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure vote. Meanwhile, the House awaits the CBO score, which is going to come out in dribs and drabs. Very conveniently, and the squad floats a spinoff from the Progressive Caucus. 1 million U.S. kids under the age of 12 have now had their first jab. It was pretty quick.
That'd be quick.
Pfizer seeks to widen the booster eligibility in the U.S. to just about everyone over the age of 18, as Canada opens up boosters to everyone over the age of 18. Meanwhile, vast majority of the world, no access. We're pretty close. Pretty close to the vast majority. Maybe the majority.
But when they do get access, they'll quickly pass us in the percentage that's vaccinated, like Australia just did.
Exactly. New report. Unvaccinated Texans, 40 times as likely to die of COVID. Unless, of course, they're multimillionaires and have their own doctors and take a day off from their podcast and go get monoclonal antibodies. U.S. and Moderna in a fight as Moderna is trying to essentially steal the patent from U.S. taxpayers for their vaccine that was developed with the help of taxpayer money and funded with taxpayer money. Inflation spikes in October as supply chains still broken. And COP26 draft agreement will express alarm and concern over climate change. Whew, that should do it. And union voting of Starbucks employees in Buffalo begins as Howard Schultz steps in it. Big time. All this and more on today's program. There is a National Labor Relations Board appeal. The Howard Schultz and Starbucks are trying to stop this vote in the Buffalo area, but the vote looks like it will continue on. It's going to be interesting to see how that happens, because Howard Schultz spent a lot of money greasing, I'm sure, as many Democratic hands as he possibly could at different times. Hello, Emma Vigeland, who is here because it's a day.
It's a certain day. Yeah.
It's any day that ends with a day that is not a weekend, you're here.
Yes. And
thank you for that.
You're welcome. It's hump day, obviously.
Oh, shoot. I forgot
you missed
about that.
I thought you were leading up to that.
Nope. Forgot.
People should really check out More Perfect Union and their work on all of these unionization efforts. They interviewed some of these Starbucks employees who shed some light.
We'll talk about that story.
Oh, we do. Oh, we will.
We will. We'll talk about it. Okay. Oh, yeah. No, are you kidding? The opportunity to shit on Howard Schultz in this way is just absolutely
An S-bomb right at the top of the show.
Shoot. I didn't mean to do that. I got a little loosey-goosey the other day with my language.
Yeah, you dropped like 7 F-bombs in the Jimmy Dore story.
It was appropriate, but the problem is that it spreads like COVID.
Like a virus.
Just a reminder, this day in history, 1898, we did a show on this, right? We interviewed somebody. When did this come up? Was it with Susan Mettler? I cannot remember. But this day in 1898, the wake of Reconstruction, armed bands of white supremacists descended on the city hall in Wilmington, North Carolina, and forced both black and white elected officials to resign. 2 days earlier, Wilmington voters had elected a biracial city government to the dismay of white groups known as the Red Shirts, who had tried to intimidate black voters. There was a growing and actually just significant political power by black people in this country during Reconstruction. Elected, that we saw this in South Carolina. We saw this in terms of all across the country, particularly in the context of the South, where you started having elected black officials. And this was just, I think, the most sort of like clear-cut case where it was like literally just a coup. Led by Alfred Moore Waddell, who declared that he would, quote, choke the current of the Cape Fear River with black bodies. No one's quite sure exactly the exact number of black people killed because these guys took over the government. Why would they even come up with a number? But estimates are as high as 100. And apparently McKinley declined to intervene or provide any assistance to Wilmington's black residents. Mm. The mob was permitted to seize political control of the city, appointed Colonel Waddell as Wilmington's new mayor. But you don't really hear that much about that in history class in anywhere. And of course, if we were to even attempt to teach stuff like that, we would be rightfully accused of being overly woke.
Yeah, teach both sides.
Yeah, what about the side of the, like, how unfair it was that
race coup
that black people got elected?
And how cumbersome it would have been to count all of the black bodies that were murdered. And
so woke.
Yeah.
So woke to teach this in school.
I'm sorry for saying critical race theory and speaking it here on this program. I hope that nobody censors us.
I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, like, if there was a story of, I don't know, in 1905, how the elected leaders in Cleveland, Ohio, were overrun by a, if there was no race involved in it at all, how would that not be a story that we would know about?
Well, I mean, we lose history like Blair Mountain too in West Virginia, for instance. But if it was middle class people, for instance, white people, then you would definitely know about it.
Absolutely. Of course. Yeah, I know Shay's Rebellion. This part of the story, it's just, and the thing is, there were at least a half a dozen Wilmingtons during that era. A little more housekeeping before we get on with other things. Just a reminder, two things. One, we have a live show that's happening January 16th. We're going to start to announce, I think, in the coming, maybe next week, we'll announce who one or two of the guests are. We'll do it out in dribs and drabs. I'm not sure.
A very CBO score of you.
Yep. That's what we're going to do this, like with the CBO score. And then you decide whether or not you want to participate. But you can go to majoritylive.com or majoritireportlive.com. Buy your tickets. Do it now, folks. Tickets are selling like hotcakes. We may actually sell hotcakes there.
That sounds nice.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Contemplated, but yeah, know. Probably won't. No. Probably
who's
going
to make the hot
pass?
Cake? Probably me.
I'm not
going to
be standing there.
Also, reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We lost a member, and she wanted me to know why. And for the life of me, I can't quite figure it out. So I'm not going to say her name. She's been a longtime member of the show, and she wouldn't respond to my email. She gave five reasons. One is your analysis in the 2020 primary wasn't accurate. The Bernie movement bringing out lots of new voters, not true. Young voters wouldn't support anybody else, not true. And she disagrees with my belief that Elizabeth Warren should have endorsed Bernie.
And I say that, I've said that not just for, well, actually for her sake. And I'm not talking to the writer of this email, Elizabeth Warren. Had she endorsed Bernie, one of two things would have happened. Either Bernie would have won and Bernie would have owed her whatever she wanted, yes. Or Biden would have won and Biden would have been able to, she would have been able to deliver the Bernie people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Biden still won, but I was just assessing what was in the best interest of Elizabeth Warren.
She doesn't seem to have a good grasp of that.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But it gets worse. You tolerated sexism and misogyny on the part of the MR crew during the primary without calling your crew out. Well, anybody who... Oh, snake emojis, et cetera. Anybody who uses snake emojis is no longer on the program. Not necessarily by my choice, but... recent analysis seems repetitive and lazy. Well, I can't argue with that. That's true. Your chicken, and this is this I find baffling. Your chicken S coverage of Russia, Russia, Russia. Straw men, both sidism. Gah, you were just wrong. The more we learn, the more we realize it was worse than we realized.
Uh-huh. Wait, so she was,
I don't know. I know you're going to ask me. And I don't know the answer to that.
Which side of it is she on?
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know what side she's saying that we were on.
Right.
How do you know what I was going to ask?
Because that's the obvious question. It doesn't make any sense.
Sexism and misogyny here at the Majority Report.
Well, all right. That's a good point. All right. But this is the one that really, really got me. And I had to actually ask about your failure to acknowledge a specific episode of white male privilege that you either... We got an IM about this. Of white male privilege that you either accepted or worked to make happen. I know you know there was something in that show that you didn't deserve. I did a show called The Show in 1996. Okay? I know that because you told us the story. I don't remember the details, but I know you know what it is.
Oh,
yeah. Now,
stop being coy.
And she wrote, the fact that you played a white man is irrelevant. Was it a writing credit? Black women I trust hold this episode in your career against you, and I believe them. Your denial feels dishonest, and this dishonesty was a last straw. I want to make this explicitly clear. The show was written by the executive producer of Martin. He wrote a sitcom about his experience as the white head writer of a black variety show. I was cast. I didn't write anything. I had no, it was an audition. Everyone I auditioned against was a white guy because the role literally said Tom, whatever the guy's last name was, .. a white head writer of a all black variety show. I have no doubt, and I feel like I've gone through this multiple times, that there have been, I have had the privilege of being both male and white in numerous instances in my life. Almost like this show is almost premised on that notion. But the one time I could say, like, no, the part was for a white guy. There was no instance. Now, maybe if they had written a different show, but that was not completely out of my control. I could have said, I'm not going to do this.
Out of principle, but you're an actor trying to make it.
Well, but wow. Then they would have put, like I think Bateman was also up for it. Yes. It would have been Bateman, maybe.
This is a existing in society criticism.
I mean, this is detached from reality entirely.
A little
actually.
Bit, yeah.
But
yeah.
The point being...
She hasn't seen the show, but she heard from some other people that it's problematic, and thus she will hold it against
you.
Yeah.
It was weird. So... With that said, there's an opening for a member on the program. And so you go ahead, join themajorityreport.com, and maybe for members we'll release the first episode of the show. And Paul Giamatti was on that one.
What goes through your mind when we're thinking we're going to start with the news and you choose to do this at the top of the show?
I completely, sometimes my brain just doesn't go the right way.
None of us knew that was happening.
Just no, I didn't either.
I didn't either.
I didn't know it was going to be at the beginning. I was just like looking at my papers. I'm like, oh yeah, this thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we did. I'm glad we got what's
important. We'll get to other stuff soon. Let me just remind you folks, mysolarnerd.com. This I also didn't anticipate. Danny over at mysolarnerd.com. He's the solar consultant, fan of the show, longtime listener of the program. He has worked for years in the solar industry, got a little bit turned off by what he saw was predatory behavior by some outfits that work on solar, people getting trapped in contracts, maybe that they thought would expire earlier, et cetera, et cetera. He knows there's a lot of homeowners out there that aren't aware of the solar options that are available, and things like it's possible to retrofit your home with solar panels with no money down. And most homeowners that switch to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. And a big part of this is the solar investor tax credit. It's a 26% tax credit. It has been extended with COVID through 2022, through the COVID bill that passed in the spring. Then the following year, it drops down to 22%. So get on this, folks. What My Solar Nerd does is analyzes your usage, finds the best equipment for your needs, determines the incentives and financing you may qualify for, because sometimes there's some state benefits as well, in addition to the federal benefits. And then they project manage the process between you and the installers, obtaining permits, et cetera, basically, you know, almost like your solar doula, if you will. Yeah, Bradley. Honestly, that's, you know, it would be nice. It'd be nice to have, like, you're a navigator. It would be nice to have this in every aspect of your life.
MySolarDoula.com.
Well, somebody should get on that. But for now, it's MySolarNerd.com. Some markets are prone to power outages, and you may qualify for off-grid backup solutions as well. Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system. Go to MySolarNerd.com. Fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select the Majority Report listener for how you heard about MySolarNerd.com to let Danny know that you're listening to the show, too. And that way you'll also get your $200 gift card upon installation. Check it out. Great service. And obviously, I would imagine most people know the benefits of solar. All right, Len, I want to welcome to the program Bart Elmore. He's Associate Professor of History at Ohio State University. Author of Seed Money, Monsanto's Past, and Our Food Future. Do we have Bart? Oh, here we go. Hey, Bart, thanks for joining us. We're here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, great to see you all. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here.
This, it's really interesting to me because I have been talking about Monsanto just in the context of news for about 15 years. And at different times, it's been a very controversial subject because you get into, Matt and I were just talking about, there was a long time we would get into big arguments with some of our listeners about the idea of genetically modified food. So we will get into to that aspect. But you went and did basically a history of this company, which in many respects, some, at least in name, doesn't exist in and of itself anymore, although its legacy sure does and its products do. But how did you end up going back and studying the history? How did that come about?
Yeah, I certainly didn't know they weren't going to exist at the end of the book. You know,
you've been working on this for about 8 or 10 years. Is that right?
Yeah, almost a decade now. It started when I was doing my dissertation at Virginia, weirdly of all things. So, and at that time, I didn't see any of the things that came down the pipeline. Bayer buying them, all the Roundup litigation, all this stuff that's happened since. To be honest, I was finishing a book on Coca-Cola and its environmental impact around the world. And I was looking at the ingredients that go into Coca-Cola and thinking about the environmental effects of extracting all those natural resources from around the world. And so the table of contents was essentially the ingredient list on the back of a Coke can. And, you know, I was going through all these ingredients, talking about coca leaves, for example, things like that. And I got to caffeine and I just was stumped. I couldn't figure out where Coca-Cola got their caffeine from. And so I started looking into this and turns out it was Monsanto that was Coca-Cola's caffeine supplier. And I ended up traveling to St. Louis and finding out that Monsanto's corporate records are housed there in St. Louis. And I got permission to access those records. And so that's really where the book began. I put a kind of pin in it and said, I want to come back and do this history from the bottom up, starting in 1901 when the company was founded in St. Louis, and trace it all the way up, as you said, to the period of genetically modified foods and crops and things like that.
So the company has started essentially because a guy, it was a Keeney, I think I have here, wanted to be able to provide chemicals that, you know, in the United States, as opposed to from Europe. Let's just talk about like what they were doing as they start to move into to this, like trace for us what the lineage of products are, because one could have imagined that this was a company that was dedicated towards, I don't know, agriculture or, you know, development of food. And that's where the idea of Roundup Ready corn came from. But it sort of came from the other direction, poison, essentially. Right?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I think, interestingly, so to answer your question, I mean, so we go back to John Queeny. In 1901 in St. Louis. And this guy, if you think about who he is at that moment, he's actually a pretty bizarre character. I mean, he's in his 40s. He's already tried to have his business, start his own chemical business in the United States. And it's failed. In the late 19th century, his business had burned down in East St. Louis, and he'd sunk all his life savings into this. I have two kids now, and so I feel for him too. He had two children right at that moment, and he's like has no money. He's cash strapped, and he's trying to figure out how he's going to go on and make money on his own. He's really a drug salesman at the time. Doesn't really know much about chemistry at all. In fact, there's this great hearing that he has where the senators are kind of grilling him, I think, on the chemicals that he's selling in the 1920s. And one of these senators say, you know, Queeny, could you tell us a little bit more about this compound? And Queeny says, this is a quote from the hearing. He says, "Sir, you're getting into chemistry, sir, on which matter I'm rather weak," which is funny because this company is going to, as you said, create all these different things, not just Roundup, but really producing plastics. And I mean, honestly, looking around your studio or even behind me here, almost everything has some kind of connection to this petrochemical world that Monsanto helped create outside of food. So yeah, he really doesn't know much about it. In fact, he imports all his chemists from Switzerland because they know what they're doing. And what's the supreme irony of this is the whole point is to not have Bayer controlling them, you know, to not have German companies producing all these chemicals to produce it in the United States. And, of course, in the very end, Bayer ends up gobbling up Monsanto. I don't know how Queeny would feel a century later, but that was the beginning. And the two products they produced then, from the very start were saccharin, an artificial sweetener for Coca-Cola, and caffeine, which it also produced for Coca-Cola. Without Coca-Cola, there would be no Monsanto. That was really the beginning of the rise of that company.
So then Edgar Queeny, his son, takes over the company and broadens out what they're offering, which is basically anything from soap to plastics and plastics that you would, you know, put in food.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much, you nailed it, pretty much everything. It's interesting, when I went into the archive, you could see these graphs and ads they had where they would show just like a desk or a room, and they would have, you know, little lines coming from all the things in the room, and all of it was some kind of Monsanto creation or Dow creation or DuPont creation. You know, the paint, even the varnishes, you know, the insulating fluid and all the electrical equipment, you know, pesticides for sure, insecticides, all of these things. But that to me was really one of the things that drew me to it. You know, Coca-Cola is a company that's everywhere and you see it. I mean, you can't escape it. You can walk down any hallway and you're going to see a Coke product. Monsanto was different. It felt like it was a company that was everywhere, but we don't typically acknowledge it, like its presence. It seemed to have such outsized influence on our economy, and yet it was kind of hidden in plain sight in a way. It was making all these things, but never really serving the consumer. It was always providing these things to industry that served consumers.
Right. I just want to make that clear. This is a business that would make chemical additives that were components of other products. So when people make, they didn't make plastics, but they made components that allowed plastic to harden or to maintain some durability or ability to be painted or stuff like this. This is a very much a like business to business business. But then they also started to get into things like pesticides, right? And that's when they started to become more arguably direct to consumer.
To some degree, yeah, to farmers specifically. Their slogan was still serving industry which serves mankind, which I always appreciated because I think that's actually significant for the whole story of Monsanto. You know, this company realizes that if it can turn the minds of a few businessmen, or if it can sell these products to some wealthy and influential farmers, then they can change the game. That really and really change how we eat, which we'll talk about later, you know, when we get to genetically modified foods. But if we can convince this relatively small group of people, you know, you think about the late 20th century, 2% of Americans are farmers, that this is the way to go, then we can change, we can have this revolutionary effect on agriculture. And you're right. The beginnings, it was actually late. I was really struck at how late Monsanto was getting into pesticides and agricultural chemicals. It really starts in earnest in the 40s. And you had said this. I mean, we now know that there's this great history detailing the ways in which a lot of these products were wartime products. You know, they were developed, some of these insecticides, as nerve gases, you know, potentially as chemical weapons for war. But also these herbicides, you know, the whole intent originally in the 40s of something like 2,4,5-T, which is going to become part of Agent Orange used in the Vietnam War years later, was to see if we could find ways to get rid of these jungle environments to allow soldiers to fight more effectively. So from the very beginning, I think it's important to point out that with this pesticide and insecticide kind of portfolio that Monsanto is going to create, it's coming out of a mindset of war. You know, it's coming out of a mindset of annihilation in many ways, an argument of extermination, and creating that idea that pests need to be annihilated. That was very much a part of the ethos and the branding and the marketing that we see in the 40s and 50s when Monsanto first starts creating some of these chemicals. And I should say DDT was one of those first chemicals that it creates, this insecticide that, of course, Rachel Carson, this great environmentalist, would write about in the 60s. They branded their DDT Santoban, always had these wonderful names with Monsanto somehow embedded in it. They were producing that in the 40s and would do so going into the 40s and 50s. And it became a huge, they realized, wow, look at all this acreage. Look at all this potential to sell chemicals. This is an area where we want to start pivoting and investing a lot of our money. So you see that in the 40s and 50s taking off.
How much of that culture, because at one point you mentioned the 2,4,5s. 2,4,5, which is that agent, which was that compound that is in Agent Orange.
Yes.
And they would pay their workers a bonus to essentially make themselves deathly ill. Really, I mean, really what it comes down to, right? And I just, like, how much, you know, and I... have, you know, interviewed over the years some of the trial lawyers who probably worked on these Monsanto cases, and heard stories of cultures in corporations that have, you know, the cultures exist through generations. And I'm just curious as to, like, you know, what you found in terms of that culture when you do start as someone, as an entity. So much of their success was rooted in developing stuff that is either going to kill people or kill, allow people to be killed, like,
or then kill pests,
or but kill pests. But it's, but the idea being that their value of human life as a corporate culture seems to me is a little bit degraded.
Right. Yeah. I, you know, what was so interesting about that Agent Orange story, my father, for example, was in Vietnam. And so some of this is somewhat personal. You know, you have everyone, I think, has a connection to this story in some way when we talk about Agent Orange. And again, the active ingredient that was the problem in Agent Orange was this compound called 245T. It was contaminated with this compound called dioxin, which Dow Chemical, and I think this gets to your point, Sam, writing to Monsanto secretly in 1965 says, and I quote, "This is the most toxic chemical compound we've ever seen." And this is 65. So, you know, everyone who knows their history, 66, 67, 68, 69, this is happening. But for me, I wanted to go even deeper, as you said, as a historian. When did they know this compound was problematic? Was it 65 or even earlier? And you're right. I decided that it was important for me to go listen to the workers, to go into the plants where this stuff was made. So many people had talked about the veterans for good reason and the effects on veterans, and also about Vietnamese citizens, which I also traveled to Vietnam for this story. And I wanted to tell that story, but it mattered to me that what happened to the people actually making this stuff in the factory, and what did Monsanto know? And so to that, Sam, I mean, in 1949, that's when Monsanto first started producing this 245T that would become Agent Orange. So we have years, in other words, of exposure to this within the plant. And I did. I drove down. You can't make this stuff up when you're writing it. A town called Nitro, West Virginia, you know, this explosive town that was made named after munitions manufacturing during World War One, where Monsanto had their plant. And I met the attorney who represented many of the workers inside that plant who tried to sue Monsanto because of their exposure to this compound that it, even in their own documents, they said was super toxic. And I got to meet these folks. You know, in 1949, there was a worker, I'll just tell one little story, named James Ray Bogus. And, you know, you get to know these folks by reading their depositions and getting to know their story. And, you know, here's a person who finished high school. His father was laid up, had been injured. So he had to go to work, and he ends up working as a kind of garbage man of sorts for the plant there at where they're producing 245T, this toxic compound, in 1949. And there's an explosion at the plant, and he's exposed to a large concentration of dioxin. And it becomes very clear, dozens of the other workers, including James, their face develops what's called chloracne. You can't miss it. In other words, it's not something that you know, you would know that your workers are suffering from systemic health problems because your face turns into these acne pustules. I'm not trying to be graphic just for graphic's sake, but I think James's story matters here, that this is what Monsanto is seeing in 49. A guy has, you know, back and arms are riddled with this acne. The doctors, if you go in and find these confidential reports from inside the company that I have in the book, will say you could smell the chlorine coming out of their body from another room. I mean, that's how exposed these folks were to these things. And, you know, 49, 51, 52, you see these records, same, it's continuing through the regular process of 245T. And I'll be clear about this too. This stuff is being sold to gardeners, to American citizens, while this is all happening, even before the Vietnam War. And one could say, well, how is it that they would let that happen? And I found this one document, and I'll shut up after this, but this one document that really struck me in the archives, and it was of the medical doctor who was responsible for overseeing these workers. And he says very clearly that he believes that most people complaining about health problems inside Monsanto are kind of a disgruntled tent. People that are just unhappy with their work and, you know, upset with their managers or whatever. And that's why they're complaining. And as I write in the book, you know, if that's how you view workers, when someone comes to you with their face, and I'll say one more thing about James, he had to peel off his face five times, the actual layers of his skin, you know, and this is all in the record. This is not conspiracy theory stuff. This is stuff they saw, they wrote about, they documented. And, you know, you just have this tremendous exposure. If that's how you see workers, then yeah, maybe you missed that, you know, but that was really, to me, startling, that kind of culture that you see as early as the 40s and 50s in the company.
How did this coincide with the decline in farm labor that was pretty precipitous from 1950s to the 60s? Because I would also guess that this was when Monsanto was also moving to more rural areas as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, they wrote about this very clearly, that what we're seeing is this mechanization of American agriculture, the New Deal, of course, and the government subsidies that allow and push capital into mechanizing American agriculture means that, you know, people are trying to farm with fewer laborers. Chemicals become a way for them to say, look, this is what you need. Instead of having to go out and have people weeding fields and things like that, all you need are these powerful herbicides that we can provide you. Not telling them, of course, that what we're seeing internally at our factories is this really awful story. And one other thing I want to say about that factory, Monsanto, the workers lost that case against Monsanto. And if you look at, they sued them in the 1980s, dozens of workers saying, you know, we were clearly exposed to this. And they sue and they lose. When they lose, Monsanto actually takes out liens on their homes to make them pay the court costs of Monsanto. If you don't pay us, then you're going to have your house taken away. And Sam, you were talking about lawyers, and, you know, I'd worked a little bit as a, you know, the public defender's office, so I knew a little bit about this. I really spent time with the lawyers to talk to them about it. And he said he pulled all these folks in and said, folks, look, they might take your house. You know, we shouldn't go on appeal. We should just let this ride. I don't want you to lose your house. And the workers, James was one of them, said, look, Stuart, they can have my house. I just want 30 days to get out. That's how dedicated they were to fighting. They were willing to sacrifice even their homes to continue to try and appeal this case. They lose. But interestingly, I tracked down the jurors in that case because I was so troubled by it. I saw in the archives this document that they requested the judge to read when the judge gave the verdict of the jury. And they said, we can't find in favor of the plaintiffs because of the strictures and technicalities of West Virginia law, basically. But we want it on the record that we believe these workers were harmed. And, you know, we believe these chemicals in there were the cause of that. Years later, that one, the foreman of that jury, there was a journalist that tracked him down and showed him a piece of evidence that he wasn't allowed to see during trial. Because, again, of a legal technicality, the judge did not allow this EPA document showing how widespread the contamination was, even in the 1980s around this plant, was saying it had no bearing on what was going on in the 40s and 50s. And the juror, I swear to you, he says, my verdict would have been different. You know, I would have decided in favor of those workers if I had seen this. And at the end of the interview, you just feel for him because he says, I can't get this out of my head. You know, I feel like I let these folks down. And a lot of these people would end up dying. I lead with this story because they're not here to tell that story. And to me, I think that's why I went back in time. You know, I think people talk a lot about what happens in the latter part of the 20th century. But as we were saying, the roots of this are so much earlier. We see a culture being developed that I think is going to have this harvest, if you will, later in the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a devastating story, and certainly the liens against the home was a way of essentially threatening future litigants.
Totally.
Like, this could easily be your fate. It's also not hard for me to imagine that a judge in West Virginia at that time might have other sources of revenue or income, frankly. And we should also say this is a company that also developed PCBs, right? Which is another sort of ends up being a chemical that ends up causing a tremendous amount of harm in health impacts on people. So let's move forward to what I think end up being Monsanto's biggest product, and also I think they're where most of their renown starts to come from. They develop Roundup first, right? I mean, this is the thing that I think people don't fully appreciate sometimes, that it didn't start with like the idea of like, what if we had a product that was that you know would survive a an herbicide? They started with the herbicide.
Yes.
I mean, we talk about that development, and then how they decided, like, well, wait a second, what if we found something that would our herbicide wouldn't work on? Then we could corner a whole nother market.
Yeah, exactly. So it's all connected, and Emma's point is so important, because so much changes in agriculture by the 50s and 60s with farmers, you know, mechanizing their operations, and with this kind of flight from the rural countryside, which makes these chemicals that much more important and easier for Monsanto to sell. This is the way you can farm. You don't have to have all these laborers. You can have chemicals to do your work for you. And it's actually 2,4-5-T that they're trying to get away from when they create Roundup. You know, Roundup is created at around 1970. And it's right after the Vietnam War. They're searching for something that's going to be non-toxic. And that's how it's pitched originally. Roundup is going to be this safe and environmentally friendly herbicide. And it's super weird, actually, because you'd mentioned detergents. And the reason that glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, which has phosphorus as its base, is the chemical, is because they're getting out of the all detergent business. So all, like, A-L-L, lowercase a, detergent is a Monsanto creation, back to, like, all the things that they created. And in the 60s, we have this eutrophication problem, algae blooms up in the Great Lakes, and detergents are partially blamed for that, phosphate-based detergents. So Monsanto is sitting there that has all this phosphate that it's mining out of Idaho, all of this capital infrastructure in phosphate. And now they got to get rid of all that phosphate in their detergents. And that's how they create Roundup. They're trying to figure out what to do with all this phosphate they have. And bam, they're doing these experiments and they find glyphosate in 1970. It's ultimately approved by the EPA in 1974. And you're right. For decades, it becomes this blockbuster herbicide. It becomes the first billion-dollar herbicide in history. Broad spectrum kills weeds super effectively. Farmers love it. But boy, wouldn't it be great if you could engineer your crops to be resistant to it so you could spray it even more.
What was going on with the EPA at the time that they were rubber stamping this kind of stuff? I mean, was there just a generalized connection with industry or an eagerness to perceive these as technological advancements? Or was it just we don't know, or they were not aware of how this was going to affect people down the line?
A great question. And, you know, think about the timing of this. It's kind of perfect timing for Monsanto. This is right when the EPA is being created. Yeah. And it's really nascent. It doesn't have the reputation yet. It also doesn't have necessarily the resources as the Nixon administration. And what you see, and I think this is a story that echoes throughout the book, is the ways in which the companies that are being regulated become the regulators in a way. They're producing the science, the studies that ultimately are used to decide, well, is this stuff safe or not? And often being, you know, a lot of the company science and company reports are what these agencies lean on. They don't have necessarily the capacity to go out and do all these toxicological studies. And that was like the most surprising, or I mean, not the most surprising, but at least most problematic story throughout all this. It's just that cozy relationship between Monsanto and the EPA, which of course we can talk about later when it gets to, you know, Roundup's reevaluation in recent years, and these emails that came out in court cases where you'd think these folks were best friends, you know, and this revolving door too between the people working inside the OPP, the pesticide program within the EPA, and companies like Monsanto. So I think it was a product, Emma, of both. Like, it's the timing. It's not really up and running yet, right? It's just starting in some ways. And it's so reliant in so many ways on company-funded science at that point to approve some of these things.
I mean, we still see that in the context of the FDA and the EPA, for that matter. And really what the EPA or the FDA does is really more evaluate the self-reporting of these things. Is it done differently in Europe? I mean, is it done differently in Europe in the way that they do that with that dynamic? Because, you know, as we move forward, at one point, I think it was in 2005, Europe, was it 2005? Europe said, we're not doing these genetically modified products anymore. We're not into that. Whereas in 2005, in this country, Matt and I were saying beforehand that golden rice was going to solve the world, the hunger problem, which, you know, the idea of it is okay. But cool. talk to how Europe does it differently. And then let's move into, once they have saturated to the extent that they can, the herbicide market, they come up with a sort of, I guess, you know, the killer app, which is the genetically modified corn, essentially.
Yeah, and soybeans, cotton, and a whole host of other things. Totally. Just to answer that, I mean, I think we actually see some countries initiating a kind of moratorium on GMOs in Europe as early as 1999 in certain pockets, and then of course, it becomes more formalized in the early 2000s, as you note. And there is a little bit, there's more of a precautionary principle in terms of regulation, as opposed to, let's put this out. In the case of the United States, when GMOs are being first introduced in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, think about that political moment. This is the time of obviously Reaganomics. And then, of course, George H.W. Bush, who appoints Dan Quayle, his vice president, to be ahead of this competitiveness council, of which the number one thing they're looking at is biotechnology and how can we fast track this new technology into the market. And in that moment, the U.S. basically takes this stance that genetically engineered crops or foods produced from genetic engineering will be regulated and treated the same as crops that are bred via conventionally bred and conventionally, conducted crop cultivation. And the line in the Federal Register is substantial equivalence, that there's enough of a kind of similarity between the way genetic engineering works and conventional breeding works that we're not going to have special regulations for these products. And that is what leads to the European backlash. You could argue that because we had such a kind of, hey, it's open, you know, do what you get this to market as fast as you can. There was this perception in Europe that this wasn't really vetted as it should be. And can we trust it? And I think the swiftness with which it was introduced was one of the problems for Monsanto. And they even admitted that internally by the 2000s and 2010s when they're facing all this backlash. They would say things like, well, we were being a little bit arrogant. Well, in some ways, I think we see that pretty clearly in the record, trying to push for this. But yeah, the first Roundup Ready crops, the first crops that are genetically engineered to tolerate heavy spraying of Monsanto's signature herbicide Roundup. And you nailed it. That's the goal from the company's perspective is we're a chemical company. We have this billion-dollar brand. This is what we want to make crops do. That we want to allow them to tolerate spraying of our very profitable herbicide. They were successful in 1996. We're at the 25th anniversary, in other words, of the introduction of the first kind of large-scale commodity crops that are genetically engineered. And I'll say one other thing about that. The way that they found the Roundup Ready trait to make crops tolerate spraying of Roundup, they found that actually at their waste dumps outside of their Roundup manufacturing plants. They found there was so much pollution, as it were, effluent, that they found these microorganisms, actually agrobacterium, that had this ability to tolerate glyphosate. And so they were able to take that gene from their own waste piles and insert that.
So in other words, they'd look out on their waste piles and say, wait, there's something alive in there. Let's take that and commodify it, essentially. All right. So, and let's be clear. I want to just like the promise of genetically modified organisms. I have two questions about this. A, what were they as presented, not just by Monsanto, but the community? And I'm a lot less skeptical about the potential for GMOs. And I'm also skeptical about the dangers about GMOs in and of themselves. But no capitalist enterprise is developing GMOs for them not to be reliant on something that is a sort of subsidiary or complementary product, right? It's like nobody, no printer maker is out there making printers these days that isn't going to need a lot of ink.
Right.
And that is, I think, sort of what has always been my concern with genetically modified organisms is a little bit less about the implications of the modification in and of itself, but what is, no pun intended, downstream from that. And so what was the promise? And then how soon after was it clear to Monsanto that some of those promises were not happening? Like, for instance, it developed a resistance. I mean, so walk us through that.
Yeah. You nailed it too. And I think I always like to be clear on this. I studied biochem when I first went to school, and I even worked with PCR machines, and the idea of genetic engineering was not something that I thought was just inherently evil in its own right. You know, I thought, wow, there's potential here. This is really exciting. And I came at this work that way. And I also should say I came at this work knowing that Monsanto is often labeled as Monsatan. You know, that literally that is like a bumper sticker people have, that they consistently are at the top of polls for evil corporations. I felt I owed it as a historian to try and come in with as clean a slate as I could to try and understand the human story. Like that medical director that I talked about earlier, you know, why, how might he have missed this? Well, in that case, I feel like he missed it because he looked at laborers a certain way. But to this period, you know, I got to interview Bob Shapiro, who was the head of the company in the 1990s. He was the CEO who launched these seeds. I liked him, you know, but for whatever that's worth. I mean, I felt like here was a person who, to your point, really believed in the mission of what these things could do. I think there was two promises that he made at that time that he believed in, I think earnestly. One is that this will radically increase yields, that, you know, because we can genetically engineer these crops, that we'll see this big boost in food production. The second was that it will radically reduce our dependence on petrochemicals, you know, that, and this, I mean,
those are related. I mean, if I plant a seed, then I get three times the amount of whatever it is, corn, cotton, soy. I need to do less planting. I need to have less, you know, gas powered machines going through. I need to have less. I mean, this would have been the idea of that is a good idea and not just a function of, you know, of profits.
Although
obviously there is profits associated with it, but it's not just exclusively that, that's the motivating factor.
Totally. You know, I mean, again, you know, around the office, people, he wanted to have people call him Bob. He didn't have a corner office. He was actually in a cubicle on the floor with workers. You could say, oh, this is just for show or whatever. I, you know, having talked to them, you know, the way he responded to emails to a lowly at that time graduate student and just like immediately writing back. And, you know, even more substantive, he, you know, protested the Vietnam War. He played guitar with Joan Baez out in the Washington Mall. I mean, he was really a person who, he read Bill McDonough, all these great luminaries, environmental sustainability thinkers, Paul Hawken. He was really moved by all this stuff. And I think he bought it, you know. And one of the things I think this story, and I talk to my students a lot about this, is like, you're going to be in a position like this where the promise of a technology is going to be held out to you, and you're inside a company and you kind of want to believe it, you know, and you have to be skeptical. I think you have to sit there and say, you know, is this a little bit too much? Is this promise something that we can really actually accomplish? But he did. He called it the Microsofting of Monsanto. And by the way, this is the dot-com boom of the 90s for, you know, folks who didn't live through that. I mean, every time I was writing during this period, you know, I'm thinking of AOL dial-up and the sounds and all this. And he's definitely speaking to that audience of like, we are going to be a digital company, basically. These genes are like software. We're selling software that's going to make plants smarter, and they're going to do all these great things. And you see this rebranding of the company to speak to shareholders who are going crazy during that dot-com boom. But those two promises are what he says are going to happen. But you said, when did they start seeing it? So they actually produced studies, I kid you not, where they scientific studies where they say Roundup will not develop resistance in weeds. Where they say that we've been using Roundup since the 70s. We have this big track record to look back on. Glyphosate, or Roundup, the active ingredient glyphosate, will not create Roundup resistant weeds. It just won't happen. I'm at Ohio State University here with some of the best weed scientists in the country. And I will admit, when I first went to the first weed science talk, I thought it was about a different type of weed. But I still was very excited when I found out these folks were doing this incredible research here on weeds and their resistance and adaptations. And they were saying it internally here. They tell war stories about the early 2000s where they're saying, Monsanto, look, we're seeing resistance. I mean, within the first few years after this stuff was introduced, almost immediately, you've got to tell farmers this. You've got to change your way. And what you see in the book are these stories of the weed scientists here who had Monsanto reps coming in and saying, you guys don't know what you're talking about. You can't publish this. And my weed scientists, you know, now friends in many ways, saying, who are you telling us what science we can or cannot, you know, we're at a public university. This is what we're finding. And at some point it didn't matter. Farmers got the news because it wasn't working, you know, as well as before. The weeds started taking over. And that, you see that very clearly in 2005, 6, 7, 8, just this explosion in species that are resistant to Roundup. So it failed tremendously there, because what we started seeing was farmers having to go back to older and often more toxic chemicals to try and beat back those weeds that had developed resistance to Roundup. And so now we actually see 2,4-D, you know, a chemical that was the second half of Agent Orange that's being sprayed in tremendous quantities right now that was produced in the 40s. So the future of food, in some ways I describe in this book, is really the past. Like, we're not going forward in many ways. We're going to 50s, 40s chemical technology to try and deal with this resistance issue that anyone could have seen coming.
But in the meantime, what Monsanto is able to do is, if not completely, but certainly come close to attempt to essentially monoculture or monocrop everything, right? And corner the market. I mean, it's been years since I followed Monsanto closely, but when I did, it was in the era of, you know, Canadian farmers attempting to fight the fact that their neighbors, you know, some bird ate some corn in their neighbor's patch, flew over, took a dump in their fields, and some of the Monsanto gene gets into their corn, and all of a sudden they owe Monsanto money, or you have people who can't save their seeds year to year.
Yeah. Yeah, the save the seed things is key to the story. I actually looked really closely at this because I, like you, you know, growing up in that period, I remember Percy Schmeiser and those stories. And part of this story is also trying to figure out what's myth and what's not. You know, what I found no evidence of is that drift story of pollen drifting and then Monsanto suing, which was important for me. I felt like I needed to be fair to the story of like, okay, what truly happened, what didn't happen. There are tons of cases, as you noted, of farmers somehow coming into possession of seed and Monsanto coming onto their property with Pinkerton detectives and saying, you now have our technology. You didn't pay for the technology use agreement fee for that. And we're going to sue you for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that did happen and still happens. I don't know if we can do it on the show, but you can call a number still to this day, 1-800-ROUNDUP. Any of your listeners can do this. I just did it in my class yesterday, where we had the whole class and we called the number, and where you can rat out your neighbor for using Roundup Ready traits without paying for the technology. For example, maybe somebody has a little extra left over and they want to just give it over to their friend to use. If you use it without paying the fee and a neighbor finds out about it, they call this number and you press 2 on 1-800-ROUNDUP and it says, tell us about the misuse of seed. And then it'll say your call will remain anonymous. So one of the things here that we see is
that just a reward. I mean, I want to, it's like swatting people essentially.
So, yeah. The reward is.
And that's what you see in this case of Percy Smyser in Canada and others, is just the tearing of the social fabric of farming country asunder, where you got people calling and ratting on each other and, you know, helicopters being sent in. So that was all true. You know, that this kind of, and it was radically different. I mean, this was just the idea you couldn't save soybean seeds or cotton seeds. You know, farmers were just blown away by all this new kind of surveillance system. But I think what's happened recently is even more dangerous and scary. And that is the issue with dicamba, this new herbicide that's been brought back to deal with Roundup resistant weeds that has a tendency to vaporize and volatilize. So basically what happened was Roundup resistant weeds took off 2005, 2006. Monsanto knew they were screwed at this point. We've got to figure out a solution. So they started selling a new set of seeds that had Roundup resistance and dicamba, this other chemical resistance. So now you could spray your farms with glyphosate and dicamba. It'll kill the weeds, but it won't kill the crops because they've been genetically engineered to resist it. The problem is that dicamba is an old chemical. Again, the future is the past. It's from the 60s. And the reason that farmers didn't use it a lot was because it's dangerous. In hot temperatures, it vaporizes. So it lifts off target. Farmers say it jumps if you talk to them, which I drove around with extension service agents to talk to them. So when it jumps, it drifts and will go far distances off people's fields onto fields that don't have those dicamba tolerant seeds. So if you're a soybean farmer and you don't buy Monsanto's dicamba tolerant seeds, you get hit. You can get hit with drift and it will affect your crop. If you're a peach farmer or if you own a vineyard, there are no dicamba tolerant vineyards. There are no dicamba tolerant peach farms, peach trees. They get hit.
As a farmer, one of these sort of like tangential farmers, can you prove that it's dicamba fumes essentially that is doing this? Like, is there some type of legal action for something like this?
So I went to it. I couldn't believe it was happening. I never saw any of this coming. Remember, I started this years ago before there was even a dicamba tolerant seed at all. And then right as I'm finishing this book, this case goes to trial where a peach farmer says, we're going to try and, you know, hold Monsanto accountable for this. I learn about it in the middle of the semester and I'm teaching and I'm talking to the attorneys and they say, we're going to trial. It's going back and forth. I don't know when the date is. And then it just turns out, okay, it's going to be in January, 2020. You got to be here. I literally teach my class. I jump on a plane and I show up because I don't know what documents are going to be sealed. I don't know what's not going to be available after that court case. So I'm sitting in the gallery. And I was, you know, there, I actually had a student with me, a research assistant, and we're just taking notes, like ready to go. And I kid you, one of the interesting things is that was in Rush Limbaugh courthouse. You can't make this stuff up. So it's Rush Limbaugh's grandfather. This is actually where Rush is from, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. And Stephen Limbaugh, his cousin, Rush Limbaugh's cousin is the judge. A very mild-mannered individual, I should say. But this case was a peach farmer that was saying, come on, I'm farming over here with my peaches. The leaves are cupping. You can see this kind of symptom of dicamba affecting my crops, and I'm losing my crops. And by this point, I was wondering, did Monsanto, were they talking clearly internally about the fact that Drift could help them sell seeds. And sure enough, those documents in the first hour of trial, it was just like jaw dropping. I'm sitting there. And so one of the first emails was from a presentation, a sales presentation internal. They're talking about these new dicamba tolerant seeds. And they say literally that one of the best ways to sell this will be to sell protection from your neighbor, right? That this stuff is going to drift. We know it's going to happen. And it could be a way to sell this stuff. They also restricted, this goes back to EPA and regulations, they restricted university access during this time to look at how this stuff was vaporizing and things like that. They said they had a new formulation, but they couldn't produce enough. This was their argument to universities. We're not capable of producing enough for field testing. Another email internally says, ha, 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 can't produce enough material for field testing. Bullshit. You know, I mean, it was like, I'm sitting there listening to these documents and I'm like, they wrote it down, you know, in the emails. They knew it would drift. They knew it would hit farmers and they knew it'd be a way to help sell the seeds. And, you know, back to the very beginning of our conversation, that was another one of those moments where you say, that's a toxic, you know, corporate culture, you know, that allows for something like that to happen. And that peach farmer won about 280. I think the original verdict was like $280 million. And there are now a bunch of other cases in the wings, whether this will happen. If anyone who's listening to this wants to just type in dicamba, D-I-C-A-M-B-A, and you're going to see a story that no one's talking about if you're not in farm country, right? Because this affects 2% of the population, but it's creating all this havoc. And even worse than the detectives coming in and 1-800 Roundup hotlines, this is a way of forcing compliance that it's pretty nasty.
So, and we're skipping over a lot of detail here, and folks obviously should read the book. But Monsanto's faced, you know, billions of dollars worth of verdicts against them. They are bought by Bayer. It may be one of those situations. I mean, in addition to sort of the irony of that, it may be one of those situations where it like pulls down Bayer too, because of the incredible liability they have adopted, which is not to say that Bayer doesn't deserve it for a bunch of other things that we could talk about. We go back to the origins of that company, but leaving that aside for a moment, has there been any type of reform on the EPA level? Like, it's one thing, and I have great appreciation for trial lawyers who have brought all this up and have, you know, basically made them pay in California and across the country in this regard. But at one point, one would expect the EPA to say, hey, like, okay, this money being paid out, I mean, justice served, I guess, on some level. Of course, there is all sorts of poisoning and irrevocable harm that has been done to humans and to our environment over the course of the last, I don't know, 40 years as a function of this. Maybe we need a structural fix. Maybe we need to adopt a different standard that is where the burden of safety is, is the threshold is just simply raised higher for these manufacturers of this type of stuff.
You know, I love listening to your show because you always have historians on and you think y'all think very like structurally about this stuff. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, my takeaway would be that tort litigation didn't prove effective for Ray Bogus. It didn't prove effective for even the veterans of that were in Vietnam that were exposed to this stuff. That was $180 million settlement split between seven companies. $180 million, which is split between Monsanto, Dow, and a bunch of other companies. It was such a sweet deal to them. This is in the book as well, that they went into the judge's office after the case was decided for the veterans for that settlement. And the plaintiff's attorneys are cheersing each other with champagne with the judge because they were completely let off the hook. And I think, you know, we're trying to fix these problems after the fact, after people have been exposed to these chemicals, after they've been, you know, harmed by this. And I think I am a little bit heartened. Remember that with dicamba and all these things, the first dicamba tolerant seeds were 2015. And then we started seeing all the problems in 2016, 2017. So you've got the Trump administration in office and an EPA that's willing to say, well, they made marginal adjustments. Like, we'll put buffers on where you can spray. You can't spray this close to the edge of your field. But of course, the problems persisted. Drift is a crazy thing. I mean, you can have inversions where this stuff spreads long distances. What I think we're seeing at the EPA right now is a discussion. I mean, one of the reasons I'm talking is because I think this history can be relevant to politics today about whether dicamba, as it's currently being used, should be approved for use in the next growing season. You know, given that we saw even this last year, thousands of complaints from farmers about drift. We have a new administration. We have a new EPA. Let's rethink this stuff. They are looking at some of these other pesticides and insecticides, and we're seeing some of these things being pulled. It has to be done that way. I think we can't wait for the guinea pigs that are farmers and workers to come down with lesions or whatever else before we step in and say, this stuff shouldn't be sprayed everywhere. And just to be clear about glyphosate, we've seen a 15 to 18 fold increase in the use of this stuff on farms since 1996. So back to that promise, it's exploded the amount of exposure that's out there, especially for workers. But of course, we find residues of this stuff in Cheerios and in our food. And so all of us are connected to this story as well. And the last thing I want to say on that is, you said yield, and I want to just circle back to that. I mean, the thing that I think is even most damning about this whole story is that all of this might have been worth it if we'd had this massive boom in terms of food production. Well, first of all, obviously, we're talking largely about commodity crops, which mostly go to fodder for animals in CAFOs. We don't have necessarily time to go into the environmental disaster of all that. But just take yield. Let's just say that this is food that humans consume. The National Academy of Sciences in 2016 did a study where they looked at this extremely closely. Let's look at yield for crops that were genetically engineered for various traits, BT traits to produce their own insecticides, Roundup Ready traits, whatever. Let's look at all those yields for corn, soybeans, and let's look at the yield for conventionally bred varieties that don't have genetically engineered traits. I remember just being mind blown when I looked at the data. It's like this.
Completely.
In other words, there's no yield. Yeah, I mean, there's no yield difference between those conventionally bred varieties and the genetically engineered ones. I should be clear, in some cases where there's heavy pest pressures, BT corn, which is a type of corn that's genetically engineered to produce a protein, BT protein, that is its own insecticide, has shown some yield improvements. But on the whole, and they're very clear about this, the National Academy of Sciences, there is no like inflection point. There was no like new green revolution or kind of radical increase in food production. And I was so astonished by it that I called the scientists, the National Academy of Sciences. I want to make sure I'm getting this right. I called them multiple times and they said, no, that's our finding. And I said, well, that's a pretty darn important finding, you know, like to talk about when people are saying, well, yeah, well, we have to accept these things because we need this food. And I think maybe CRISPR and these new genetically engineered technologies in the future are going to do cool things. I'm not going to go on record saying they won't. Who knows? You know, what I will say as a historian is that in the past 25 years, the way that this genetic engineering technology was deployed was about selling chemicals. And it was not about necessarily, you know, radically increasing our food production. And I think that's a problem.
Bart Elmore, the book is Seed Money, Monsanto's Past and Our Food Future. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Really interesting and just a devastating story, a real accomplishment. Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you all.
All right, folks. Well.
It's like put a pit in my stomach, but yeah, unreal.
It's just a cavalcade of great news. That's how we got going around here.
That's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Whew. All right.
Folks. Just, oh my God. We better have some fun stuff in the fun half.
The detail about them discovering it in the dump. Like, oh, look at something's growing there. It's like something if a fiction writer wrote that. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, let's relax.
A little on the nose.
I haven't been to Vegas, obviously, now for... I think I've missed two... Yes. Two cycles. Probably four trips to Vegas. Yeah, four trips to Vegas for the tort lawyer conference. I'm going in April, and I'm sure they're going to have it in April, but we missed April and October. You know, where it would every interview, not every interview, but the vast majority of the interviews would be just a reminder of just how depraved corporate culture can be. And, so it was nice to have a little reminder there without having traveled to Vegas. Mm-hmm. At least in Vegas, I get to like spread it out and, you know, like focus more on the $200 I lost at blackjack.
This was like a staycation.
Yeah. Staycation. But I don't have the distraction. Like, you know, if I lose any money at blackjack, it's like, I become obsessive about it. Like, yeah. I'm down $40. What am I going to do about that? And it makes me not think of the horror. But this, we just get the full horror. So that was great. Mm-hmm. Folks, just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. I'm sorry. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. For those of our listeners, if we still have you, who were always mad when we would talk about the detriment that GMOs, not in and of themselves, but as commodities in our capitalist system, go ahead, Matt, because the GMO wars around here, Emma, you have no idea.
It seems like that was...
Do we have anything even remotely equivalent these days?
Vegans?
No, not even.
Nuclear
I mean,
power?
The only thing I would say is equivalent is my white privilege in playing that white
nuclear
head
power,
writer.
Maybe.
Honestly, the closest thing I can think of is... Bitcoin stuff. You're getting in the... There's all this promise to it that's going... And I think there's... I think there's probably more promise to GMOs than cryptocurrencies in general. But, like, this idea that, like, because you're not supporting it, you're getting in the way of, like, the bounties that are promised from this technology? No. It's the capitalists that are actually going to nerf it and make it not as promising as you want it to be.
I think nuclear power is there, but nothing has achieved the level of vitriol that we would get when we would say anything remotely critical of... Again, not GMOs in and of themselves, but their function within our capitalist society.
Gotcha.
In a just a ludicrous intellectual property regime, like
exactly
where you're. Yeah,
there was a time where it looked like Monsanto was just going to be like, we wouldn't even call it food anymore; we would just call it Monsanto. Folks. JoinTheMajorityReport.com is the way you support this program. Also, Majority Live. It's where we're going to have the live show. Going to be all fun. Mostly fun.
Mm-hmm.
And check out the AM Quickie. Great stories that you may miss. Feel like you want to take a break from the news, but you also want to not take a break from the news. AM Quickie. That's what you do. Go to amquickie.com. Sign up. We will never, ever, ever sell your email address to Monsanto.
That's a good disclaimer. And very specific.
Yep. Yep. I just want all bases covered.
We will be selling it to
Golden Rice. I'm going to be promoting Golden Rice soon.
Yes.
Also, the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Check it out. Be part of the community. You can go there and rant and rave about your Monsanto stories. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Tonight on Left Reckoning, we have Paul Bowers talking about South Carolina. It's class composition, it's history, it's politics, including Nikki Haley. So patreon.com/Left Reckoning if that is interesting to you. We'll also be talking about Elaine Chausson. It's your patriotic duty to go help and work to make the supply chains go faster. And a guy who was really upset that people right-clicked on his NFT and saved it. And the existential crisis that's causing the non-fungible token crowd. So patreon.com/left reckoning.
I didn't know that you could do that.
Yeah.
I could save. It's an image.
It's literally a screenshot. You could pay, what?
Well, they think they're buying
$1 million, or you can take a screenshot.
They think that they're buying, like, some sort of, like, rights to, like, reproducing of an image, but really what they're buying is a receipt for
something held on
the server somewhere.
A certificate of authenticity.
Great job.
See you in the fun half. I mean, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, back, back. Back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.